Good morning and welcome to Occupy the Airwaves. Okay, I thought I would follow up on the Tucker Carlson, Vladimir Putin interview. One of the questions that Tucker Carlson asked Vladimir Putin, I don't think Putin gave a good answer to. Tucker Carlson asked him, how are you going to denazify Ukraine? And Putin basically said, well, we're going to make it illegal to be a Nazi. So what is it exactly that you could pass a law against and stop all of the hate that is being stirred up in Ukraine between Ukrainians and Russians? And ironically, they're all the same people, as Putin pointed out. So it's between ethnic Russians and ethnic Russians hating each other, and someone's stirring it up. So how do they do it? There's like two ways an American should recognize that they stir up hate. One's the way that they do in America when they want to go attack another country. What they do then is they stir up hate toward that country, even if Americans have never heard of it before. Who ever heard of Grenada? And all of a sudden, within a week, Americans are waving flags and screaming, kill Grenadians! Kill, kill, kill! You know, Arlo Guthrie did a takedown of how stupid it is in Alice's Restaurant, where he starts jumping up and down and going, I want to kill! I want to kill! Well, that's what they do to Americans. Americans are easier. It's like a pit bull that's been taught to fight, right? It's not that difficult to get Americans worked up, because we've just been brought up like that our entire life. So that's one way they do it. They do it with external enemies, and they just use propaganda, as we know. So we know how the propaganda works. They just tell you 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, how evil the other person is. But what if it's in your own country? What if you are, say, Yugoslavia, and you have been taught your entire life, as most people were, that Croats, the Serbs, the Albanians, you're all brothers and sisters, right? Even though you just went through World War II, where, like, the Croatians, for instance, massacred in the most brutal of ways hundreds of thousands of Serbs. So it's only a few years later, and they're already being taught kind of peace and reconciliation. You know, that's how they did in some African countries after the civil wars there. They did peace and reconciliation things where people would go and tell each other, you know, well, we're really sorry we did that, you know. My bad, I didn't, you know, I just got carried away. Of course, it didn't always, I remember reading in Harper's once that didn't always work in terms of, I'm not mad at you anymore, but it worked in terms of, I ain't gonna say it out loud because it is frowned upon by the society at large. The powers that be don't want us being mad at each other anymore. And what's more, if I try to kill you the way I was allowed to just a decade ago, I would be in trouble. So it definitely comes from the top. So let's talk about Yugoslavia, where they'd been brought up since World War II, talking about peace and brotherhood. But then after the Soviet Union was destroyed, the United States went after Yugoslavia, and they wanted to destroy it. So we were told that the evil Serbs all of a sudden started attacking all the other people in the country. But why? Why did that all of a sudden all these nationalities start fighting each other? This is called a confession of a CIA agent. They gave us millions to dismember Yugoslavia. And this is from GreenvillePost.com. And the CIA agent is Robert Baer, B-A-E-R. And he wrote a book, Secrets of the White House. And this was a publicity tour from October 10th, 2012. And it's an interview. And the interview says, when and where was your first job in Yugoslavia? And Robert Baer said, I arrived by helicopter with three agents. We landed on the 12th of January, 1991 in Sarajevo. Our job was to keep an eye on alleged terrorists of Serbian nationality who were expected to attack Sarajevo. Now remember, we were told later on in like 1998 that they did. But this is 1991, okay? And the question was, who are the terrorists in question and why were they supposed to carry out these attacks? Then he says, they gave us files about a group called Supreme Serbia, detailing plans to conduct a series of bomb attacks on key buildings in Sarajevo in opposition to Bosnia's ambition to leave former Yugoslavia. Did that group ever exist and what exactly were you doing in Sarajevo under CIA command? No such group ever existed. Our headquarters lied to us. Now, this is a CIA guy. So when people say, oh, they could never keep that secret, too many people would talk. Well, he's talking now, but at the time he didn't know. They can keep people in the dark and feed them bull. We should all know this. So he was told, you've got to go look at terrorists. And here's the terrorists. And here's a folder that tells you all about them. And it was all a lie. They don't just lie to us in America. They lied to CIA agents. Our mission was to alarm and spread panic among politicians in Bosnia, simply to fill their heads with the idea that Serbs would attack. To begin with, we accepted the story, but after a while we started to wonder, why were we raising such hysteria when the group clearly did not exist? So then he says, how and when did the mission end, and did it have a name? And then Robert Baer said, for me, it ended after 2 weeks, and I landed a new job in Slovenia. The operation lasted a month and had the name Istiva, that is, truth, although it was anything but. Why did you go to Slovenia? I received instructions that Slovenia was ready to declare independence. We were given money, a few million dollars, to fund various NGOs, opposition parties, and various politicians who inflamed hatred. So this is how they do it. They inflame hatred. And so I'm going to skip now and I'm going to go to Rwanda. This was 1991. The United States is stirring up trouble in Yugoslavia. Now let's go to Rwanda. There was a horrible massacre in Rwanda in 1994 in which the UN wanted to step in and send peacekeepers to stop it. But Madeleine Albright, on behalf of the Clinton administration, put a stop to it. Even though there were no Americans that were going to be in this peacekeeping thing, America stopped the UN from stopping the massacre. And then, after they enabled the massacre to continue and hundreds of thousands of people were killed, then they started the big propaganda thing about genocide in Rwanda. And that's when they came up with the whole, oh man, they need the United States to step in. That's when they came up with responsibility to protect, even though it was actually the United States was responsible for enabling the massacre. And then when they wanted to bomb Yugoslavia, later on, remember, they'd been in Yugoslavia since 1991, stirring up trouble when they wanted to actually bomb Yugoslavia. Well, then they used Rwanda as an excuse to bomb Yugoslavia. They said to the American people, you don't want the same thing to happen in Yugoslavia that happened in Rwanda, do you? No, no, no. We need the mighty USA to go in and put a stop to it. And then they went in and bombed the heck out of Yugoslavia, killed thousands of people, displaced thousands more, blew up a chemical factory, polluted the entire Danube River, blew up the Chinese embassy. Remember that one? Oh, we had old maps. We didn't know that was a Chinese embassy. Remember that? Yeah, they did all that. They killed far more people than ever would have been killed in the Civil War. But that's how they do. They did the same thing in Iraq in 2003. Went in, overthrew the government of Saddam Hussein had Shiites and Sunnis and atheists and Kurds, all of them were in the government. They all got along, and then the United States went in there and started stirring up trouble. This was in 2005. They got John Negroponte and Robert Steele out of retirement. These are people that stirred up war in El Salvador in the 80s, sent them over to Iraq. They stirred up trouble. People who had been cooperating to try to get America out of Iraq, the invaders out of their country, got incited to fight each other. That's how they do. Propaganda and then some provocations. They set up death squads on one sect and they blew up the mosque of another and they got them all fighting each other. What they used in Rwanda was the radio. That was the thing that most people got. They didn't have cell phones back there where they could push the propaganda on the cell phones. So they used radio. And so this is from the Duke University, and they have actually recordings of the radio broadcasts, which were used to stir up the hatred and then the massacre among the people. Again, one people. It's not the same thing as like, oh, we hate Panama, we hate Grenada, we hate Vietnam, we hate Korea, whatever, the way they do in America. This is stirring up trouble within the country. And oh, by the way, when you listen to this, think about what they're doing in America now. For years, we've been stirred up to go fight external enemies. But what if they're now deciding to destabilize the U.S. the way they destabilized Yugoslavia and Rwanda and Iraq and Ukraine? Think about it. So anyhow, this is from the article. The Rwandan audio tapes of the International Monitute Institute records are comprised almost entirely of the transcripts of radio broadcasts translated from Kinyarwanda into French and English. These are the broadcasts which aired in 1994 during the Rwanda genocide, which took place from April through early July of that year, and which 800,000 Tutsis and moderate Hutus were massacred. And there you go. There's always the moderates who won't go along with it For instance, in Ukraine, the OUN murdered not just Jews and Poles and Russians, but any Ukrainian who didn't go along with it. And they're still doing that, by the way, in Ukraine today. Oh, and the same thing happened in Serbia, where the Croatians who wouldn't go along with the massacre of the Serbs, they were also killed by the Ustashi and their descendants, depending on what period of time you're talking about. The genocide was triggered by the assassination of Hutu President Habyarimana on April 6, 1994. An AMI piece on radio as a tool of genocide summarizes his events. During colonization from the late 19th to the mid-20th century, the German and Belgian colonial elite manufactured a native elite in the Tutsis, a process of colonization that Frantz Fanon describes in The Wretched of the Earth. Hutus thus experienced discrimination in education in various sectors of the economy. In 1959, Hutus took control of Rwanda following the independence movement, forcing many Tutsis to seek refuge in neighboring countries. In 1990, the Rwandan Patriotic Front, comprised of exiled Tutsis, invaded Rwanda, initiating a civil war. Habyarimana's assassination resulted in an escalation of Hutu anxiety that the Tutsis would seize power of the government and that discrimination against Hutus would be reestablished. Radio became a powerful weapon used to incite and direct the Rwandan genocide. What I found particularly interesting about the content of these broadcasts, the transcripts of which can be found in the IMI organizational records, was the way in which its efforts to direct the extermination of the Tutsi population was paralleled by its efforts to claim authority over the telling of history. The radio broadcasts reveal a struggle over who gets to tell history and therefore a struggle over a monopoly on truth. And this is the thing, if one particular sect, in our case, the Democrats and the media, claim a monopoly on truth and no one else can talk and no one else can give a differing opinion, and they are really trying to clamp down on free speech in order that they have a monopoly on what they call truth, air quotes. In other words, the RTLM broadcasts exhibit a phenomenon which seems to be more universally true, which is the political necessity of storytelling, or as I call it, the narrative of propaganda. There are a few particular conspicuous aspects of the history telling of the RTLM broadcast, one being the discourse of revelation or enlightenment, the idea that if we could only peel back the layers, we can finally see the truth. And this encounter with the truth is the basis for political action, or in this case, the basis on which genocide becomes justified. Slavery, for example, is a term that is repeated throughout these broadcasts. Several journalists recall the state of Hutu slavery during colonization in order to characterize the discrimination Hutus experienced. Drawing on such a vocabulary, the radio broadcast attempt to illuminate the Rwandan genocide as a slave rebellion. Freedom from slavery, according to this narrative, lies in the ability to discover the true history and nature of that discrimination, in opposition to the stories of the colonizers and the elite. For the same reason, I'm less interested in the truth or accuracy of this or any construction of history than in the need and tendency to construct history more generally. And then he goes on, if you want to see this, it's at Blogs Library Duke Education. But now I'm going to go to what they're doing in Ukraine and have been really since the Soviet Union was destroyed. But it got way worse after the coup of 2014, which we're coming up on the anniversary of. It's almost a 10-year anniversary of the U.S.-backed coup that overthrew the elected government of Ukraine and kicked all this pro-Nazi stuff into high gear. And all of it could be outlawed very easily because it's coming from the top down. Just like in Rwanda, just like in Yugoslavia, just like in Ukraine, and it can be stopped if it is no longer allowed. Quit teaching these kids this stuff in school. Quit having these parades, these torchlight parades, glorifying Stefan Bandera. Okay, so this is called From Nurseries to Nazis, Ukraine's Terrorist Radicalization of Children. It is by Deborah Armstrong, and it is on Monthly Review, but now it's called mronline.org. From Nurseries to Nazis. And then she quotes the Bible, train a child up in the way he should go, and when he is old, he will not depart from it. And then there's a video of a little kid, but it's been taken off of YouTube. How about that? I wonder why. She's talking about the video. The year is 2015. The little Ukrainian girl is wearing a Hello Kitty t-shirt that says, Love Cat. She looks to be about 4 or 5 years old, maybe younger. She is holding a knife in her tiny hands. From off camera, her father says, Marinochka, will you count Russians? But he uses a slur for Russians. Yes, she shouts. What will you do to them? He asks. She shrieks, I will cut Russians! She repeats this phrase several times and makes little thrusting motions with the knife. Then she gives a Nazi salute. Sieg Heil, she says. Sieg Heil! Her father laughs. The video of the little girl was posted well before Russia crossed Ukraine's borders in February of this year. Again, 2015 is 1 year after the coup. So yeah, well before Russia crossed the borders. On YouTube, you can find hundreds of videos of Ukrainian children saying they will kill Moscow, singing songs about how they are ready to fight for Ukraine, waving knives, shouting slogans, and giving Nazi salutes. Such videos are all over social media, and they have been appearing for many years. Okay, well, this is naive of Deborah, because this has been removed from YouTube, and I bet all the other ones have too, because they don't want you to know that there are Nazis in Ukraine. This may come as a shock to you, but it's only shocking if you do not understand the history of Ukraine and what has been happening there since 1991, when the Soviet Union broke apart and all of its republics declared independence. Independence has been important to some Ukrainians, she means Western Ukrainians, since at least the 1920s, when the Organization of Ukrainian Nationalists, the OUN, was founded. I have previously written about the atrocities of the OUN and its leaders, including Stefan Bandera, a Nazi who served alongside the Wehrmacht during Operation Barbarossa. It is an indisputable fact that the OUN, led by Bandera, murdered more than 100,000 people. In fact, the bodies of the victims are still being exhumed today. And then there's a picture of a bunch of bones that were dug up in Poland in the 90s. And then don't forget that the Canadian Parliament gave 2 standing ovations to a Waffen-SS veteran who was in one of the units that helped kill the Jews and the Russians and the Poles in Western Ukraine. And Justin Trudeau and Vladimir Zelensky, by the way, participated in the standing ovations for the Waffen-SS veteran. The list of the OUN's atrocities is long and well-documented, despite the amnesia which seems to have swept over much of Europe and the United States. Here are the most famous ones. The Lviv pogrom of July 1941, in which several thousand civilians, mostly Jews, were brutally tortured and murdered. 2. The massacre of Babi Yar near Kiev between 1941 and 1943, in which Ukrainian nationalists were complicit in the murder of tens of thousands of people, including Jews and Ukrainians loyal to the Soviet Union. Like I said, just like in Rwanda, just like in Yugoslavia, the people that are doing the mass murders, they'll kill their own if their own don't go along with it. 3. The liquidation of the Jewish ghetto in Rivin in July 1942, where over 5,000 people were killed. 4. The razing of the Belarusian village of Katyn in March 1943. 5. The massacre at Wolin, a region in Nazi-occupied Poland that is now part of present-day Ukraine. There, between 1943 and 1945, more than 100,000 Poles were slaughtered, along with several thousand Ukrainians who were thought to be Soviet sympathizers. And that is only a partial list. Feel free to check all of the links I've included in the above list. Even the Smithsonian does not shy away from giving credit to the Nazis' Ukrainian collaborators. This is from Smithsonian. Redlin attributes the Nazis' particular brutal occupation of Belarus to 2 key factors. First, the country was home to a thriving community of Ashkenazi Jews, 90% of whom were killed during the Holocaust. And second, its landscape of swamps and forests was well suited for guerrilla warfare. Acts of resistance by partisans led in turn to widespread massacres of civilians, like what happened in Katyn, located around 30 miles north of the capital city of Minsk. Diaries, archival records, and eyewitness accounts studied by Redlin suggest that a group of 75 Belarusian partisans ambushed the Shmamaskov Battalion 118, an auxiliary unit dominated by collaborationist Ukrainians. For every German soldier stationed on the Belarusian front line, between 15 and 20 collaborators were on hand to help oversee occupied territory and quash partisan resistance. And then that's as much as she quotes from the Smithsonian article. The OUN behaved like bandits, raiding farms and villages and targeting civilians. They slaughtered Jews, Roma, Russians, communists, and anyone they suspected might be loyal to the Soviet Union. The Banderites wanted a racially pure Ukrainian ethnostate, and they believed that anyone who was not Ukrainian needed to be purged. That is the story which history tells, but it is not the story taught to Ukrainian children. And again, if you really want to really turn a country into civil war, what you do is you spend a couple decades teaching the children to hate each other. And I'm reading you a story about what they've done in Ukraine since 1991. They're teaching the kids, and then she's got a YouTube that apparently isn't scrubbed yet, of little Ukrainian kids reading books about how to hate Russians. In 2013, schools received the first edition of the Rebel ABCs. I wonder if that's part of the $5 billion that Victoria Nuland said the U.S. spent on overthrowing the government in Ukraine. You think? Here's something I know for sure. The United States supplied the textbooks to the Pakistani madrasas in which little boys, there they only let boys go to school, were taught to hate Russians. The University of Nebraska wrote and printed the books, and then they were handed out to the Pakistani madrasas, and they were used to teach the little kids to hate Russians. For instance, they taught math by saying, if there are this many Russians and you kill this many Russians, how many Russians are left? So I know the United States was in back of that one. I don't know about this one, but I wouldn't be surprised. Ukraine has been impoverished ever since the Soviet Union was destroyed in 1991. They never recovered. Russia was also destroyed in the 90s and millions of them died. I don't know how many died in Ukraine. But Russia clawed its way out of it once Putin came into power. Ukraine never did. So they're still dirt poor. That's why you can buy Ukrainian women and Ukrainian children. That's why. People don't sell themselves and their children unless they're impoverished. But anyhow, I think Victoria Nuland had something to do with this in 2013. In 2013, schools received the first edition of the Rebel ABCs, a textbook which teaches elementary school children the Ukrainian alphabet with a colorful cartoon story about the OUN. Unlike the real OUN, who roam the backcountry raping, murdering, looting, and burning, the OUN in this textbook is portrayed as a merry band of friends who romp around the countryside doing good deeds. The author of the book, Oleg Vertrytsky, is proud that the textbook will teach the children to be real Banderites, unquote. He designed it like a comic book and gave the characters cute names. There are more pictures in the book than text, but let's look at what the text says. And then there's a picture from the book. Here you can see little Alyamik, the hero of the story, whose name means alarm, carrying his trumpet and leading his merry band of Banderites. In the background, the Russian Kremlin is ablaze. This is in a school book for little children, teaching them their alphabet, okay? M is for Moskovia, which means Muscovoy, an archaic name for Moscow. The word is written with an A instead of an O, which mocks the Russian pronunciation of the word. There is a short poem. Muscovia is the Khanate of fear, massacres and mausoleum mass. There, Lily Putin is the emperor. Medvedevich is a lackey there. Almarvik will put on his Mospinka. He'll load his machine gun and his finka because he knows the day will come when Medvedevich and Lily Putin, just like Tutin of old, will fall into rebel hands. Lily Putin, of course, is a reference to Vladimir Putin, and Medvedevich is a reference to Dmitry Medvedev and former Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych, who was ousted during the 2014 coup. Marzipinka is the type of cap worn by the OUN, and Finka is a dagger. Vatutin was a Red Army general who liberated Kiev from the Germans and was later killed by Bandera. And this another thing they do is they have been tearing down statues of Soviet heroes that liberated Ukraine and all of Eastern Europe and Russia. And they're tearing down the statues of Soviet war heroes and putting up statues of Stefan Bandera instead. The Banderites have been teaching children to hate the Moscows, a slur meaning Russians, for decades. They have long cared about the education of future warriors of Ukraine. In 1996, a comic book was produced portraying Stefan Bandera as a hero, and then in 2007, it was reprinted with the title Ukraine in its Struggle. The comic tells of brave insurgents who selflessly fight the Moscow murderers. The artist, Leonid Pachevsky, depicts the OUN soldiers, compatriots of Hitler's Wehrmacht, as daring heroes fighting against the Soviet allied forces in World War II. The Soviets, of course, are depicted as ugly and bloodthirsty. And this is, again, what they said in Canada, in the Canadian Parliament, when they introduced the Waffen-SS veteran. They said he fought the Soviets. Yeah, he fought the Soviets on side of Hitler. I mean, come on now. Ukraine was a Soviet. It wasn't even Ukraine until it became a Soviet. Ukraine was not Ukraine. It was a part of Poland and part of Russia until the Soviets created it in 21, 22. So it's insane to be anti-Soviet when it was the Soviets that created your country. But they aren't too smart, are they? Because you know why? Nazis aren't really that smart. And neither are people who stand up and give them standing ovations, for that matter. Or, I know, people who give them $61 billion. Those people ain't that smart either. Pervetsky himself was a member of the SS Division Galicia, and he originally created the drawings for leaflets and newspapers produced by the Ukrainian Insurgent Army. In 1953, the drawings were collected and printed by a daily newspaper run by Ukrainian diaspora in Philadelphia, United States. So what happens when you set up a rat line and you take Nazis, bring them into your own country in Canada? Yeah, then you get Nazi children and grandchildren who run your country. In the 1970s, the drawings appeared in the magazine of the Union of Ukrainian Youth. In 2013, the comics were published in a book and 2,000 copies were distributed among libraries and public organizations. In 2008, Murders by Order of the KGB was published for children about how the KGB killed Stefan Bandera. This comic, really more of a graphic novel, was published by the Union of Ukrainian Youth. According to the developers, there's nothing humorous in it, and it's intended for children 13 and older, those who are in search of a political idea. In 2021, the Russian publication Vesti published an article entitled Hate Education: Why Ukrainian Children Are Being Set Against Russia. The article is about the above photo of a Ukrainian preschooler holding a painting of the Russian Kremlin, which is burning and belching smoke. You can see the picture if you go to the article. Flames are blazing from Saskava Tower, the Kremlin's historic clock. The photo was a big hit on the internet and was reposted hundreds of times with thousands of enthusiastic comments about the beautiful new generation growing up in Ukraine. In a video, which the little girl says, "Hi, I'm not Katrusa, but Daruska, and this was not drawn by me, but a girl from Kharkov. I am very pleased that you call me popular, because Putin's castle is on fire in the picture." She cheers, "Hooray!" But the education doesn't end with fairy tales and comic books. Ukrainian children are also taught how to fight, how to fire an assault rifle, and how to kill. The following video, produced by a Russian TV show called Current Time, was uploaded to YouTube in 2015. It shows children of all ages wearing military fatigues, running obstacle courses, and firing automatic weapons at a training camp run by Ukrainian nationalists. All right, well, this is still on Monthly Review Online. 40 seconds into the video, the correspondent talks to the instructor, who downplays her questions about the Nazi symbols the children are wearing and the Nazi salutes they perform. And then you wonder why they've got so many volunteers to join the Ukrainian army and go fight their fellow Slavs, their fellow ethnic Russians. Because they've been taught this for 30 friggin' years, since 1991. After talking to the instructor, the narrator introduced a boy, age 9, who she says already knows how to fire an assault weapon. "Who will you fight?" she asks the boy. "Enemies," the boy replies. "What enemies?" she asks. "Any." "Do you realize you can go from war to here? Aren't you afraid?" He says, "No." In 2015, the Russian publication something Pravda wrote several articles about the camps where youths are taught the right spirit of Ukrainian errands. Nationals set up a network of camps for children, teenagers, and young adults in western Ukraine where they are taught weapons handling, shooting, hand-to-hand combat, and even how to fight with knives. The camps were formed after the Maidan coup in 2014 in 7 regions of Ukraine: Kiev, Kharkov, Cherganov, Cheriski, Zaporizhzhia, Dnipropetrovsk, and Transkarpathia. Some of those are actually in the Donbass. They're trying to get the little Donbass kids that rebelled after 2014. Azov Battalion, the notorious neo-Nazi group, even have a camp called Azovets for children and teenagers on the outskirts of Kiev. In Odessa, a Russian city, you can find Camp Chota, where Right Sector runs things. Children ages 4 and up can join the Carpathian Legion. and there are several camps run by Savoda Party. The network of camps welcomes boys and girls of all ages. All right, well, this is a very good article. I would recommend it. MR Online. You have to look nurseries to Nazis, and you will find it. I recommend it because this is how they divide a country and turn it into civil war. This is how they teach citizens of a country to hate each other. It starts when they're kids. All right, well, that's the end of Occupy the Airwaves. See you next week.